Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotin in Washington, D.C.
For the most part, most of the people who are conflicted over who would be better for the economy and their pocketbooks. Most of these people think the U.S. economy is in lousy shape. Their incomes are not keeping up with their expenses. They are struggling to make their monthly payments.
Recent polls show former President Donald Trump is leading by over a dozen points with male voters, while they also show that Vice President Kamala Harris holds the lead among women.
We are happy to be given the mandate so that we can restore the hope and confidence of Botswana. We can rebuild this country politically, economically, and in terms of systems and institutions. And we are sure and promise the people that we'll deliver in terms of our mandate.
Botswana's main opposition wins a majority in the recent legislative elections, ending the 58-year dominance of the ruling Botswana Democratic Party, or BDP.
She was the first lady of this nation, and when the Zambian government is arresting her for offenses of possession of property suspected to be reasonably proceeds of crime, it is, to me, is quite unfair.
And the lawyer for Zambia's former First Lady, Esther Lungu, says her arrest is unnecessary. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Emerging from one of the most diverse liberal regions of the United States, Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris has navigated a political course between tough enforcer of the law and forward-thinking reformer. VOA's Matt Dibble has this profile from Oakland, California.
My mother was a brilliant, 5-foot-tall, brown woman with an accent.
Born in 1964, Kamala Harris's story begins in the diverse and progressive neighborhoods of the San Francisco Bay Area. Her immigrant parents, Shyamala Gopalan from India and Donald Harris from Jamaica, met in Berkeley, California, where the two gifted graduate students arrived to study at the University of California.
Here it is to give you a message of hope.
1960s Berkeley was a center of civil rights and peace activism. Harris has said her earliest memories are of being taken to rallies in a stroller. By 1970, the Harris's marriage had ended. Shyamala Gopalan, with her two daughters, found an apartment to rent in an area of Berkeley known as the Flatlands.
So they lived above the daycare center, above Shelton's daycare, in a modest two-bedroom, one-bath apartment.
Childhood friend Carol Porter first met Harris at the school bus stop.
We were the second class to desegregate Berkeley public schools.
Harris went on to Howard University, a historically black college, and then law school. At a time when record levels of black men were incarcerated in California, she took a job as a prosecutor, a role often viewed negatively in the African-American community.
She wanted to go in and change things so that people weren't being prosecuted the way that they were based on systemic and structural racism.
In 2002, Harris took on the incumbent in a race for San Francisco district attorney.
There had never been a woman district attorney. She was really an underdog. But from the beginning, she had something very special.
Harris won the close race and set to work increasing convictions and prison time for violent offenders, while steering those convicted of first-time nonviolent crimes into her rehabilitation program called Back on Track. Elected Attorney General of California in 2010, she pressured U.S. banks into a $20 billion settlement over deceptive lending practices, took on the cross-border drug trade and human traffickers, and advocated for marriage equality. In 2016, Harris was elected to the U.S. Senate, where she quickly rose as a powerful voice on issues of immigration, health care, and criminal justice reform. Known for her sharp questioning during hearings and her ability to hold powerful leaders accountable, Harris became a prominent figure on the national stage. But in a 2020 run for president, Harris's campaign struggled to find direction amid staff chaos.
there's definitely been stories about high staff turnover, inability to keep talented people in her orbit.
Biden won the nomination and ultimately asked Harris to join the ticket as his vice president. The two went on to victory, making her the first woman and the first person of color to win that office. Faced with a surge of migrants attempting to cross the U.S. southern border, Vice President Harris engaged with regional leaders to address instability and poverty. She quickly became a political target.
She was supposed to be the one that was in charge of securing our border, and I don't even know if she's been down there yet.
Harris has grown more comfortable serving as an emissary on the world stage, emphasizing support and soothing tensions. And in a career defined by breaking barriers and exceeding expectations, Harris rose again, becoming the Democratic nominee for president when Joe Biden unexpectedly dropped out of the race. Matt Dibble, VOA News, Oakland, California.
In just over 9 years, former and perhaps future President Donald Trump has reshaped the Republican Party in an increasingly divided country. VOA's Tina Trin looks at Trump's attempt at a historic political comeback.
The Fox News Decision Desk can now project that former Vice President Joe Biden
has been elected President of the United States.
It was supposed to be the end, but when the end came, Donald J. Trump, 45th President of the United States, wasn't ready to admit defeat.
If you count the legal votes, I easily win. If you count the illegal votes, they can try to steal the election from us.
Trump urged supporters to prevent Congress from certifying those results on January 6, 2021.
We fight like hell, and if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore.
What resulted was a scene previously unimaginable in America that led to his second impeachment. Trump's unwillingness to take no for an answer was on brand for a man who has always burned convention.
I think what you see is somebody who has incredible confidence in his own intuition.
Russ Buettner and Suzanne Craig are New York Times investigative reporters and co-authors of Lucky Loser, an unflattering look at how Trump fashioned himself into a self-made billionaire.
He has not, since the early 80s, really trusted people who have subject area expertise on almost anything. He will always overrule them to make things the way he wants them to turn out.
Trump's buildings were emblazoned with his name in large gold letters, a brash display of his ambition and self-promotion.
He was worth $200 million when he would talk. It was the interview he gave to the New York Times, and that grew to $1 billion when he was talking to 60 Minutes a decade later.
Trump excelled at drawing attention and cultivating a brand for himself as a dealmaker. He made millions licensing his name. But behind the success were troubles. His companies filed for bankruptcy 6 times. His casinos lost money and were shuttered. Trump rebounded with his TV show, The Apprentice, which led to his biggest role yet.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am officially running for President of the United States, and we are going to make our country great again.
Unapologetic and unfiltered, Trump was a polarizing nationalist candidate.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
As president, Trump appointed 3 Supreme Court justices who helped overturn federal abortion rights.
The U.S. death toll now above 150,000.
In early 2020, the COVID-19 pandemic tested Trump. He fast-tracked the development of life-saving vaccines, but he also appeared to suggest that scientists study injecting bleach to kill the virus. With over 9 million Americans infected and a death toll exceeding 230,000, voters that November chose Joe Biden as their next president. Out of office, Trump faced multiple criminal indictments and is the first former president to be a convicted felon. And yet, he has never been more popular than he is now. Surviving 2 assassination attempts this year has only strengthened the bond between him and his supporters.
God has a plan for Trump, and he absolutely was spared for some purpose and reason, and hopefully it's to become the 47th president.
American politics has never been the same since Donald Trump entered the field. And the man who once co-authored The Art of the Comeback may now be engineering one of the biggest in American history. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
In the U.S., recent polls indicate that former President Donald Trump is leading by over a dozen points with male voters in crucial battleground states. They also show that Vice President Kamala Harris holds the lead among women. Rit Tao is the president and founder of the group called Engagios, Inc. He has spearheaded groundbreaking research in public policy, financial communications, insurance, trial consulting, and infomercials. Tao and his team recently conducted focus groups with adults in swing states who chose not to vote in 2020 but plan to vote this year. For more about his findings, I reached Rit Tao via Microsoft Teams.
Well, I've been speaking to voters who are literally the tipping point of the electorate. So some of the groups I talk to every month are people who voted for Trump in 2016, then Biden in 2020. So they flip from one party to the other. Others are key voting groups that media is paying very close attention to understand how they think. Hispanic American voters, African American voters, pro-choice Trump voting women, college students. So there's a lot of different groups that I'm talking to. But for the most part, I would say most of these folks are not undecided. Most of them have made up their minds. There are some who remain undecided. Those who remain undecided are basically torn between not liking Trump personally, but liking the economy when he was president, and not necessarily being entirely sure how Harris would govern, and having some trepidation about what she might mean if she became president, but hopeful that the tone would change with her in the White House as opposed to Trump. So you have people who are very conflicted among that minority of people who are still undecided.
What are the main issues that they think will change their mind to vote for one or the other? Not to say we are picking and choosing, but what are the key issues some of these voters have been talking to you about?
For the most part, most of the people who are conflicted over who would be better for the economy and their pocketbooks. Most of these people think the U.S. economy is in lousy shape. Their incomes are not keeping up with their expenses. They are struggling to make their monthly payments. And while they have a positive view of the economy while Trump was president, they have concerns about him. So that's why he's not running away with this. I would argue that if it had been a more traditional Republican running against Harris, that person would be running away with the election. Right now, Trump is not.
So the question I've heard some people address or talk about is, it appears a group of people are not being captured in polls that have come out recently. They said 8 years ago, it was a similar situation. There are some groups of people who do not usually come up in polls, but they come out to vote on the election day or ahead of the election. Talk to me about that.
Well, that's always a concern, right? So if you're a pollster, and I'm not a pollster, I really focus on qualitative research, focus groups, as opposed to polling. But as I understand the challenge, when you're creating a poll, what you're attempting to do is to replicate demographically what the electorate is going to look like on election day. And since we don't know what the electorate is going to look like on election day, to your point about infrequent voters who may or may not show up, it's hard to be accurate with the polls when you don't know who's exactly going to be there. In the prior two elections, presidential elections in 2016 and 2020, Trump performed better than expected among the electorate overall because a lot of people who typically don't respond to polls showed up at the voting booth. So we don't know whether that's going to happen a third time or whether the pollsters have adequately represented those people in their surveys. So it's impossible for us to know. A lot of pollsters didn't want to get burned by underestimating Trump's support, and perhaps this time are getting it right, or they're overestimating Trump's support. We just don't know for sure and won't know until the election is over and everybody looks at the data.
Rit Tao is the president and co-founder of the group called Engagios, Inc. He spoke with me from here in Washington. In Botswana, the Secretary General of the Opposition Umbrella for Democratic Change, or UDC, says its core campaign message of hope, unity, and an economy that works for all helped to defeat the ruling party. Kathlehalefele Motengwa says the victory of the UDC in Wednesday's election effectively ends the 58-year dominance of the ruling Botswana Democratic Party, or BDP. His comments came after President Mokuti Masisi called opposition leader Duma Boko to concede defeat following the defeat of the BDP during the polls. The BDP has ruled the southern African country since it gained independence in 1966. For more reaction and expectations of the people of Botswana following the just-ended election, I reached the Secretary General of the Umbrella for Democratic Change, or UDC, Kathlehalefele Motengwa.
Our reaction is that we are happy to be given the mandate by the people of this country because we have a sound manifesto that resonates with their challenges and aspirations. So we are happy to be taking over because maybe, as you know, this country has been under the past immediate ruling party for 58 years, since 1966. And we have always been of the view that our democracy was being eroded. We are of the view that there were serious socio-economic failures that needed intervention. So we were almost in a failed state. So we think the country needed to be urgently be rescued. So we are happy to be given the mandate so that we can restore the hope and confidence of Botswana. We can rebuild this country politically, economically, and in terms of systems and institutions. So we are happy and we are sure and promise the people that we'll deliver in terms of our mandate.
Well, Kathlehalefele, what do you think the core message was that convinced the people of Botswana to vote for the opposition?
The core message was that politically we were under siege because, like I've said, most of our institutions are failing and there was decay in terms of protection of human rights, and economically the people were getting worse. The rise in terms of unemployment, the rise in terms of poverty, the rise in terms of inequalities and disharmony within our society as a result of some of the socio-economic challenges. So the key message by the UDC was that we have a message in terms of our government where we'll restore their hope, where we'll rebuild this country and economically empower them so that there is economic inclusivity and prosperity for all. So we think the people resonated and aligned themselves to this message of economic inclusivity and prosperity for all.
But do you have what it takes to resolve this myriad of challenges that you have just enumerated? And how long do the people of Botswana have to wait for them to see the fruits of your measures?
Definitely. We have sound leadership in terms of our president, the vice president, and a pool of members of parliament from which cabinet will be appointed, and as well as councillors who will run our local government authorities. So we have sound, effective, and ethical leadership to deliver and promise in our manifesto. And of course, we have our manifesto where we provide sufficient solution to socio-economic and political issues engulfing this country. And in terms of our program, we'll reconstitute the bureaucracy or the public administration so that we are able to deliver what is captured and promised in this manifesto. And as soon as Monday, we'll hit the ground running. Immediately, the president is sworn in. So the people don't have to wait longer because we already have a plan that we'll put in place in terms of short-term, long-term, and mid-term. So the people don't need to wait longer because some of the benefits which don't need funding will be realized immediately.
What should be the expectations of the people of Botswana as the president gets sworn in on Monday officially? What promises are you making to them?
The expectation is that we want to restore unity among the nation. We want to inculcate a sense of hope, a sense of belonging amongst our people. We want to empower our people. We want to strengthen our democratic institution. We want to rebuild this economy so that it works for everybody. We want to bring social cohesion So that's what the people should expect. They must expect unity, tranquility, peace, economic prosperity, and political progress.
Kurt Halefile Motingwa is the Secretary General of the Opposition Umbrella for Democratic Change, or UDC. He spoke with me from the Botswana capital, Gaborone. Esther Lungu, the wife of former Zambian President Edgar Lungu, daughter Chieso Katete, and a family friend were arrested on Thursday, said the Drug Enforcement Commissioner, DEC, a law enforcement agency, which also has a mandate to investigate money laundering allegations. The properties owned by Esther Lungu that are under investigation include 15 apartments worth $1.5 million in a district near the capital, Lusaka, the DEC said in a statement. It says she couldn't give a reasonable explanation for how she acquired the properties. However, the defense attorney for the former first lady says her recent arrest was unnecessary. Charles Shangano says the former first lady denies the charges against her. The charges she faces include possession of property suspected of being proceeds from crime and money laundering. Defense attorney Charles Shangano tells me that her client plans to challenge the charges to the highest court of the land.
The arrests are very unnecessary because she was the first lady of this nation, and when the Zambian government is arresting her for offenses of possession of property suspected to be reasonably the proceeds of crime, it is, to me, is quite unfair, because such a prominent figure married to a president of Zambia, she cannot fail to own any property. More so, when she was being called by the police, the Drug Enforcement Commission, to arrest her, she has explained some of the properties she has acquired is as a result of the husband offering money to say, can we build this? Can we build this?
The issue is that the authorities say that she failed to properly account for the resources that led her to gain these properties. For which reason it is believed that they are proceeds of crime?
That conception is not correct, because one, she was a woman who was also doing some business, but that is not the issue. When officers interview you to find out where you have gotten the resources, and you explain that this resource is from the husband, then you should follow the husband for investigations, if that is the case, because she has explained that my job was one, to acquire land. And the land is cheap from the Minister of Land. It's quite cheap. So you cannot suspect someone that she has stolen money or she has gotten money by corruption. No. One thing that you must understand is the resources of this country, all the money is from taxes. And the money that is acquired as public resource, it goes into a bank under Control 99. We have not heard anywhere where we have heard that public fund has been stolen by the First Lady, not even in any single minister of this government.
What have you talked to your client about your next line of action?
Our next line of action is to pursue the matters up to the highest court of this country, because what the act says is not what they are convicted of, what she's convicted of or what she's accused of. You see, they have taken property from her, saying that she has no capacity to build such a property. No, the issue is not her capacity. The court is supposed to look at whether she has committed a crime or not. There is no crime that she has committed. And the fact that she has mentioned to say, no, I have not built this property. The money is the money from my husband, who was a former president. What they should have done is to ask the former president, is it true your wife is saying you built the property, but you put the property in your name? Is it true? And the former president should have said, yes, it is true. It's me who built the property on behalf of my wife.
Are you saying the judicial system did not treat fairly the former first lady, because some of her supporters are saying this is politically motivated, which the anti-graft agency said is not true, and that they were just following the law.
What I can say is, one, we are still arguing with the law, the decisions of the court, because one court of appeal has decided in one case to say, don't arrest people without proving a crime. So you can only get property of someone if there is a crime committed. On the other hand, the High Court, which has been formed, the Economic and Financial Crimes Court, is looking at the capacity of someone to buy property. But the Constitution, the Court of Appeal is saying it's not the issue of capacity. It is the issue of whether the property is a proceed of a crime or it is a tainted crime. The problem that we have in Zambia, in our country, is there is a case that was decided by the Supreme Court that under the section they are charging this the former first lady, you don't need to prove a crime. It's merely on suspicion. So that is another problem.
Charles Changanu is the defense attorney for former First Lady Esther Lungu. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Sierra Leone's President Julius Maada Bio praised the recent signing of the allotment of $480 million from the Millennium Challenge Corporation, or MCC Energy Compact, as a significant milestone. The agreement aims to help overhaul the West African country's energy sector. It comes as Sierra Leone faces energy challenges across the country. Local media quoted the president saying that the compact will bridge the energy gap between urban and rural areas, bringing sustainable and reliable power to communities across Sierra Leone, unquote. Ndeye Fatou Koroma is the national coordinator of the Sierra Leone Compact Development Unit. She talks to me about the agreement President Bio signed and the anticipated impact the funds will have on the country's energy sector.
It was an extremely proud day for Sierra Leoneans, and especially proud day for me, since I had been involved in the development of this compact and the many years of toiling to be able to get to this landmark moment for the government of Sierra Leone, but more importantly, the people of Sierra Leone. There was palpable excitement in the room. Everybody felt like the journey had come to this amazing end, where we were sitting there with U.S. stakeholders that we had worked side by side with to be able to sign a $480 million compact that is going to have a transformative impact on the energy sector in Sierra Leone. So it was a day of great pride, and it cemented what is going to be a long and fruitful partnership with the United States of America, working together side by side to improve the lives of the people of Sierra Leone.
What commitment did the president make after signing the agreement? Looking at the excitement and the anticipated impact this compact is going to have on the energy sector in Sierra Leone. Yeah.
So when President Bio signed this compact, the commitment that he was making to the people of Sierra Leone was that we're going to be diligent in the way how we're going to implement this compact. We're going to ensure that there's the geographic spread to ensure that all Sierra Leoneans will be able to benefit from this. Currently, Sierra Leone has about 36% access to electricity. The electricity that we do have is unreliable and has a significant impact on the cost of doing business in Sierra Leone. So that commitment he's making is that this MCC compact will become the anchor point for energy sector investments and will will really provide the reform roadmap in terms of the key critical governance issues that need to be addressed in the energy sector in order to crowd in the private sector financing, to crowd in other public sector financing, other development partners, to have a really clear plan for how we're going to transform the energy sector throughout the implementation of the compact.
What were some of the key thresholds that Sierra Leone was able to meet?
Yes, so Sierra Leone has worked diligently in transforming the MCC scorecard. So as up to 2018, Sierra Leone was not passing the MCC scorecard and had spent many years trying to figure out what were the key areas that needed focus. So the scorecard includes three areas that are inclusive of 20 indicators. We're talking about indicators in economic issues. We're talking about indicators related to the investing in people, so the social type of indicators, like how much you're spending on health, on education. And then you have the ruling justly indicators, which is related to civil liberties, political rights. So the government of Sierra Leone had come up with a plan on how we're going to transform those indicators, because to be able to qualify, you have to be able to pass at least half of those indicators. So 10 out of 20, you also need to be able to pass the control of corruption. It's called a hard hurdle. And you also need to be able to meet the political rights and civil liberties indicators as well as passing at least one indicator in each of the three categories I have mentioned. So there was a concerted effort across the entire government. The vice president was engaging with ministries almost on a monthly basis on this is the plan to be able to meet the requirements of the scorecard. And Sierra Leone, on its own, without support from any external parties, was able to transform that scorecard.
Ndeye Fatou Koroma is the national coordinator of the Sierra Leone Compact Development Unit. She spoke with me from the Sierra Leonean capital, Freetown. In Nigeria, the Civil Legislative Advocacy Center, or CISLAC, is calling on the international community to pressure the government to release detained minors who participated in the End Bad Governance protest. The group also called on the Nigerian Bar Association, or NBA, to take immediate action in advocating for the rights of the detained minors. The call came following local media reports that some of the minors under the age of 15 collapsed from malnutrition inside a high court in the capital, Abuja. They were arrested in August by the police for breaking the law during the protest. Awal Musa Rafsanjani is the executive director of the Civil Society Legislative Advocacy Center, or CISLAC, and the head of Transparency International Nigeria. He's also the head of the Nigerian branch of Amnesty International. He tells me that his organization is calling on the president and his wife to tamper justice with mercy by calling on the judiciary to release the detained minors.
We are calling on international community, we are calling on the diplomatic community, we are calling on Nigerians, we are calling on the president and his wife who have children. They should, you know, temper justice with mercy. They should do everything possible to ensure that they release these children unconditionally, because the punishment they have suffered for the past 3 months are over enough to, you know, serve even as a deterrent if they want to say they want to punish them for participating against end of corruption, end of bad governance, end of insecurity, end of hunger, which are even legitimate protests. But, you know, for some reason, some of the beneficiary of bad governance in Nigeria, they don't want Nigerians to speak against the evil of corruption, evil of insecurity, evil of bad governance. Corrupt people are moving freely in Nigeria, but see the young children, the small minors, see them how they are languishing in detention.
But others are also saying that if the law is broken, then it has to be enforced to ensure law and order in the Nigerian society. What's your take?
You know, under all the protocols and international convention and the Nigerian law, you cannot subject minors into this crook and inhuman punishment. So therefore, we are calling on the president of Nigeria and his wife to see that these are their children. And they cannot afford to be presiding over the justice administration system in the country where minors have been treated in this way. This is demarcating the government. Therefore, he has the responsibility to rise up to make sure that even if they are doing on his behalf, he should be able to intervene to ensure that these children are set free and, in fact, as a matter of fact, compensate them for the maltreatment that...
There are concerns that what has been shown and reported in the Nigerian media, it could dent Nigeria's image. Is that what you see?
Definitely, this has a repercussion of denting human rights, image of Nigeria. And that is why we are calling on the president to rise up, because he is the leader, and do everything possible to restore the integrity and the image of Nigeria and his leadership. Otherwise, this will go a long way in terms of denting the image of the president himself as a person. And of course, Nigeria, that has been going through a lot of international discrimination. So the president has to do something to save himself and save his government, or else this will go a long way in terms of making Nigeria to look bad in the eyes of the whole world. So that's why we as advocates, as Nigerians, we are also encouraging government to do the needful so that government can, at least restore its own image on the international community and also do justice to these children.
Awal Musa Rafsanjani is the executive director of the Civil Society Legislative Advocacy Center, or CISLAC, and the head of Transparency International Nigeria. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. A newly released study shows a major misallocation of climate finance in Africa by the World Bank and other multilateral development institutions. The study, which was conducted by the Working Group on Climate Adaptation Finance, is entitled Adaptation Finance and the Multilateral Development Banks From Concepts to Practice. The Breakthrough Institute, a global research center that identifies and promotes technological solutions to environmental and human development challenges, convened experts around the world for the research. The study contends that by redirecting more climate finance to adaptation projects, the multilateral development banks could help countries strengthen infrastructure, boost economic resilience, and better prepare for the impact of climate change. For more about the research findings and recommendations, I reach Vijaya Ramachandran. She is a lead researcher on the study and director for energy and development at the Breakthrough Institute.
It's very important that African countries receive financing to adapt to climate change. African countries are not responsible for climate change, but they are bearing the brunt of the effects of emissions from rich countries. And so we convened a working group of policy experts from Africa and Asia to issue some recommendations on how the World Bank and other multilateral development banks can rebalance their lending to supply more finance for climate adaptation in poor countries to allow them to combat and to adapt to the effects of climate change. What we find in the report is that to date, the multilateral banks have been far more interested in funding climate mitigation than funding climate adaptation. And so we ask, particularly for the poorest countries, that they rebalance their climate portfolios and fund more projects that will allow poor countries to cope with the effects of hurricanes or typhoons or other types of climate events.
Reading the report, it argues that by redirecting more climate finance to adaptation projects, the multilateral development banks could help these African countries strengthen infrastructure, boost economic resilience, and better prepare for the impact of climate change. What are your thoughts on that?
Yes, exactly. We think that redirecting money towards paving roads, towards building early warning systems, towards the construction of buildings that will not collapse in weather events, and also to directing money towards drought-resistant crops, towards irrigation, towards other kinds of things like better weather forecasting. These are the kinds of things that will help farmers and others in poorer countries that are not responsible for climate change. These kinds of interventions will help them to adapt to extreme heat, to coastal flooding and to other types of climate events.
The realignment that you're talking about, do you think the international multilateral financial institutions will accept this and implement it? And do you think it would help solve the problem that some of these African countries or poorer nations are confronted with?
I'm hopeful that they will accept the recommendations. You know, many African governments have been calling upon the multilateral banks to do more adaptation funding. There are institutions within Africa that have made this call, such as the Africa Adaptation Initiative and others. So I'm hopeful that the multilateral banks are listening and that they understand that African countries and the people who live in them have to cope with the result of, you know, large amounts of carbon emissions from the rich countries over the past century or two, and that really what we need now is much more resilient infrastructure and resilient crops to cope with this problem. At the same time, I think it's really important that we in civil society and others continue to put pressure on the multilateral banks to rebalance their portfolios to really actually helping African countries to cope.
Vijaya Ramachandran is a lead researcher on the study and director for energy and development at the Breakthrough Institute. She spoke with me from here in Washington. Rights groups are sounding the alarm about a spike in sexual violence and forced marriage in Sudan's civil war. In this report from Port Sudan, Harold Wilkins meets a woman who escaped the country's war-torn capital, Khartoum, after a paramilitary commander tried to force her into marriage.
Noor al-Huda Afif al-Din fled Khartoum, Sudan, around June this year. When the fighting started in April 2023, she decided at first to weather it out in the capital city. But her life with her husband and baby soon began to fall apart.
We had no electricity. We were sitting in darkness when my sister switched on the flashlight on her cell phone. That's when they started shooting at us. Literally, the facade of our home broke into pieces.
But getting caught in the crossfire was not the only danger she encountered. She also became a victim of an attempted forced marriage. The son of a commander in the Paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, one of the warring parties that has occupied Khartoum for most of the war, began visiting her at her home and insisting they get married. Her husband went missing one day and she later learned was imprisoned by the RSF. He has since been released.
The commander said he had dared to suggest that since my husband was missing, he should be declared dead and implied he might be involved in his disappearance. I told him I'm married.
Despite her protests, she was taken away from her family and forced to live in the house of the RSF commander, who also tried to force her into marrying his son. She says she was subjected to emotional and physical abuse at the house. Rights groups say countless women have become victims of forced marriage and other forms of sexual violence in Sudan's war. Letitia Bader is the Horn of Africa director at Human Rights Watch.
So we documented cases of rape, of gang rape. A lot of the rape by the RSF was happening in the context of people's homes, in front of relatives.
Al-Din says other women living in the commander's house felt sympathy for her and helped her escape one night through a gap in a wire fence. With her baby and mother, she made her way to the relative safety of Port Sudan, where she now lives in this tiny apartment. She says her own trauma has spurred her to help others who have suffered similar experiences.
We decided to go to camps for the displaced and check on people who had problems in Khartoum. So I found people who suffered from the death of their parents, brothers, also women who were raped.
Sudan's war has also seen the rape of children as young as eight, according to analysts and media reports. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Port Sudan. Sudan.
All right, now it's time for music from African Collection.
you know the plan of it, chat to me, yeah. Chat to me, girl, yeah. Wait time, make a carry you. Champagne and I was the Malibu, yeah. And the dinner, eat it just for two. Me dog, now we don't mean to be, yeah. My own, that time of the chase, I'm then no money.
That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it.
Yakali.
Motaliaki mama bango lantongo sokia boke libango loso azamo tumara muto mabe mobo miaso meli ebembe serke yakalo eske zate fasso ako senga pardon chéri koza la bumote oyanga moteme komiuta toli.
Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Douglas Impuga and engineer the great Tian Wang, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, if you fill your mouth with a razor, you will spit blood. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.
BMC mon annulé.
Quand il fait chaud na mboka, pas aussi va comprendre la bango. Que mon pépé oui oiseau louka. Et stationne à Kaipe aux allées. Et Zako absorbé par feu yasuki naïo. Après Kabolango na mboka, ma malade va peiner son bonbon. Bah la babi crane maladie de la peau.